Fighting corruption, while noble, can be dangerous. That's what our guest found out after her elderly mother was kidnapped and held hostage in Nigeria. But a maxim she was passed down from her father kept her from folding to the kidnapper's demands. Keep your nose clean, hold your head high, and never allow anyone to intimidate or blackmail you. Words that only she, but we all should live by. Today's guest is Dr. Ngozi Ongonja-Iweala, the 7th Director General of the World Trade Organization. She took office in 2021, becoming the first woman and the first African to serve as Director General. And she now finds herself, as she acknowledges, in one of the most threatening periods to world trade since the 1930s, as President Trump either threatens or imposes swingeing tariffs. Before that, she served twice as Nigeria's finance minister after working for 25 years at the World Bank, where she rose to the second highest position in that institution as managing director. A trailblazer for women, Dr. Ongonja-Iweala is a social scientist at heart, having studied economics at Harvard and completing a PhD on development economics at MIT. Her latest book, which she co-wrote with the former Prime Minister of Australia, Julia Gillard, focuses on women and leadership. There's a lot to talk about, so let's get going. Welcome to the We Society.
Thank you, Will.
I want to discuss your career, your experience in Nigeria, but you're in the hot seat as President Trump raises tariffs, blanket tariffs on China, swingeing tariffs on European exports of aluminium and steel. China has taken America to the World Trade Organization. I mean, what a situation to find yourself in. And I'm wondering, a macro view, you know, how seriously you judge it and how you think things will pan out.
Well, thank you, Will. Yes, these are indeed very difficult times, and I guess they're uncertain times. And, you know, from an economist's point of view, uncertainty doesn't play as well. And when we look at the impacts of what is happening, I think the uncertainty confronting business in this environment, and it's mostly the private sector and business that trades, I think that counts for a lot. Nevertheless, I think that I just want to share with you what I shared with many members of both the public and private sector when we were at Davos not so long ago in mid-January.
The World Economic Forum.
The World Economic Forum. And when I say this, it doesn't mean that I don't find the situation difficult or serious. Of course I do. But as I said to people there and to our members, I think that with the tariffs, we need to keep calm. We need not to hyperventilate when we hear the word tariffs. We need to take a deep breath and as I said, chill, so that we can sit back and really think about what is a thoughtful response under the circumstances. And I think that many members have appreciated this advice. Even those who have decided that they have to put retaliatory tariffs, I've said to them, the best course to pursue is dialogue. Let's try dialogue, because this is mostly not about a trade war. Trade is being used as an instrument to fulfill other purposes. So in those circumstances, there's a lot of politics involved. And I think it's wisest to also try to dialogue, approach it from a constructive viewpoint. I think we saw that in the three cases we've had with Colombia, with Mexico and Canada, after the initial excitement, things have, I think, quietened down a bit for the meantime. Mm-hmm. And those members of ours are in dialogue with each other. Ditto with China. I think the methodologies and approaches we have at the WTO that encourage members that have that have complaints about each other to use those approaches to talk to each other. And it's also a bit encouraging that some of what President Trump has asked for is for studies. We encourage that before you take some actions, you actually look at the situation to see what harm has been done. I know tariffs have been promulgated. Some of them have come into effect. Some have not. And there's a bit of a time to look at what would be the impact of some of these when they come into effect. So I'm concerned because tariff wars are not good for anyone. None of our members will do well by it. So we want to absolutely keep this down and avoid it. But I think we do better by embracing dialogue and by keeping calm and taking a considered and measured approach.
And it seems that the world is listening to you. I'm very struck at the example you gave of Colombia, Canada and Mexico. And it also seems the European Union is being very measured in the way that you urge. And the Chinese have actually decided to bring in an action through the World Trade Organization rather than kind of going for broke immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, your leadership, it's early days, but so far, bearing fruit to a degree. I mean, would you say that? Or is that, that's tempting fate, I know. So you can't say. Tempt providence, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very difficult to say. I don't want to claim any credit for anything. I give credit to all the leaders who have been able to pick up the phone and try to talk. It's very early days. I think we may yet see more excitement coming, but so far, so good. I think there's wins on all sides. And I also wish the press would sometimes report it as accurately as they can, you know, because in Colombia, it was a win-win on both sides, in both Canada and Mexico. I think both leaders on all sides are looking to have a win-win situation. And when properly handled, it can result in that. So I hope we continue. But it is tense. It's concerning. And we'll continue to try and preach the path of dialogue, constructive conversations.
Your reflections on women in leadership role, and I'd be very interested for you to kind of set out your stall on that.
I think it's more a question of, in this particular circumstance, you find yourself, what kind of organization are you leading? And what is best for the members? So whether you're a man or a woman, I would hope that it's not really too much about being a woman in this case.
Exactly, yeah.
But about thinking thoughtfully about what kind of organization am I leading and what is needed by its members so that they can have wins with each other, at least a kind of rapprochement with each other rather than be at loggerheads all the time. I think that's what really led me to this. Second is just looking at the economic analysis behind trade wars and the various tariffs. And we've been analyzing them. And when you see that really these situations do not result in wins, but in you know, negative spillover effects and all around, then you have to sit back and think what's the best way. So I think it's more my analytical background and seeing the impact of what could happen if we don't keep cool heads. And also knowing that trade is actually, most of the conversation so far is not so much about trade, but about trade tools being used to solve other problems. So you put all of that into a basket and you say, what is the best way to serve my members? It is to encourage them really to have as good a dialogue as they can. So that's more what is behind my thinking. I know people were very surprised in Davos when I at the World Economic Forum when I said what I said and when I say it now. But when they think about it, they always come back to me later and say, you know, this is really good advice. And so that's why I've kept saying it. So that's what leadership is about. Leadership is about being thoughtful of what you're leading and where you're leading and the context in which you're leading. I'm not thinking, it's not about yourself and how you project, but it's about how you best serve those that you're trying to lead. So the secretariat at the World Trade Organization is there to support members to get the best outcomes with each other. And so I was more very much in that mode. So that's my style of leadership. It's also not to have as little ego. It's not really about me. I always say I put my ego in my handbag. When I approach any problem, I don't have to be right. I just have to do the right thing. I think the second thing about leadership is to have principles and a value system to guide you. I really believe that. Because when you're a leader, you're thrown into all kinds of situations and conundrums. And if you don't have basic principles of what your leadership should be like, and basic value systems, you can easily be derailed. But if you follow those values, and those values are to make sure that whatever you do, you maximize the ability to serve people and the planet. I consider we are here at the WTO, and we should work to our purpose. Our purpose in the organization is clearly written in our founding Marrakesh document, which says the purpose of the WTO is to enhance living standards, to help create employment, and to support sustainable development. So it's all about people. And so I always ask myself, you're supposed to be here leading an organization that works for people. What is the best way? What are the values you need and the principles that should guide your leadership?
Looking back on your life, the 10-year-old in Nigeria, fetching water from the river some miles away and kindling wood from the forest some miles away, got an eldest in a large family. I mean, did you ever expect to wind up where you've wound up? Well, it's extraordinary. It's a great story.
Yes, when I was young, I lived with my grandmother in the village whilst my parents were studying abroad in Germany. In those days, from the age of 1+ to about 8+. So that was when I was doing all the fetching of the wood and the water from the streams before going to school in the morning. And this primary school was in our backyard, my grandmother's backyard. It's still there today. I love to drive by it. There I learned really strong principles of working hard and being responsible from a very early age. I learned to cook when I was very young. So all these things you do, not just to be good in school, but also to be a responsible person in the household. And when my parents came, they both came back from Germany. They both became academics. So my life switched from the village to, the university, primary school, and a much more privileged set of circumstances. But again, all of this didn't mean that I was thinking I was going to end up as Minister of Finance in the country or as head of the WTO. I was actually headed for an academic career. That's why I did a PhD. But somewhere along the line, I went to do an internship at the World Bank and decided I rather liked the work there. And I liked being able to serve poor people all over the world and to learn from one country to the other things that could be taken back to my home country. And I've never regretted it because I learned so much working in the Middle East, in East Asia, all over the world. There was a lot to learn and bring back that was relevant for my experience in Africa and Nigeria. But all of these things, I would say that my leadership journey was very much shaped by my upbringing because I was told from a very young age that education is a privilege. It's a right, but it's also a privilege. And that privilege means serving people. So I always thought my education had to end up with service. And of course, I was going to be an academic, and that service was teaching other people and, interacting with the younger generation and helping them along. So I think that really shaped the way I looked at the world. I wasn't just there to get my degree and then find the best job somewhere and earn more money and be comfortable. My parents and my father in particular wasn't about your being comfortable. He was about what are you doing with the education and what service. He educated 19+ people in addition to his own children, all the way up to many of them up to university and beyond. So really we could see it in action.
Yeah.
And I think that really made me feel that whatever I do in life, whatever leadership journey has to be about serving others.
I began the introduction with reference to this kidnapping of your elderly mother and how you held out there. That must have been an extraordinary episode to live through. And yet you got to the other side. Mm. And just talk us through that.
I actually didn't handle it very well. I wasn't that brave or anything. I was actually pretty devastated. I felt very, very, very guilty that any job I could be doing would lead to my own mother's health and life being jeopardized. And I was crushed, to be honest. I think I was sitting in my room. I remember that from the day she was kidnapped, not really able to function very well and to eat or do anything, and on the phone constantly with my brothers to see if the kidnappers had made any demands. And until my father came, my father had was not there in the home when she was kidnapped. He was away at a conference in another part of the country. And when he was told about the kidnap, you know, he was just the best father anyone could wish for. Instead of going home, I thought he would go straight home to their house in my hometown. He decided to come to me. And that was because my father is that type of, he discerned that I would be in very bad shape and that he was better off coming and supporting me than doing anything. So all credit to him, he arrived in my house in Abuja, found me in the bedroom, you know, just sitting there crying and miserable. And then he said, you've got to get up. You have to get going. You need to go to your back to your office. You need to function. And my father was an economist, statistician, and demographer. And he said, look, your mother and I have outlived our lives anyway. We're in our 80s. If we go now, so be it. You know, and that was his way of really getting me to laugh and, you know, get going.
You were Minister of Finance at the time, weren't you, I think?
I was Minister of Finance, and it was because of the work we were doing, trying to clean out, you know, the corruption that was in the oil accounts where we were paying, you know, subsidies for oil at the time for refined petroleum and paying it to marketers who would bring in this refined oil, which would be sold at subsidized price to the public. And so we would have to compensate them, you know, for the subsidies. And but there was, we found a lot of fraud. We'd audited about $8.4 billion worth of accounts. I just felt there was something wrong because the amount we were paying just kept ballooning. So I asked the President Goodluck Jonathan, who was extremely supportive, could we audit these accounts to see what was going on? And we got one of our most wonderful private sector people to take a break so he could lead it, the MD of a bank. His name was Aidi Mokwede, and he's led this team, which eventually even went to work under the presidency for their protection, not under me. And they audited the accounts and came up with about $2.5 billion or so worth of fraudulent claims, which I then went to the president and said, we can't pay this. And he said, I'll back you up all the way. And that was when those marketers making those claims ended up kidnapping.
Let's move on, but just quickly, how did the story end?
The story ended with, you know, my going back to work and doing all the things and showing them that we were not going to be given and be crushed by this. The president was fantastic. He sent out the police, the army, also went out combing the surroundings around my hometown. And I think the heat became so much that I think my mother was left in the middle of a forest clearing by herself. And when the kidnappers, who normally stayed with her, one would stay through the night, three of them would leave. When they didn't stay with her, they left her alone through the night and she kept waiting. She figured, well, something is wrong. They're not coming back. And maybe I should try to move. And she managed to loosen the ties on her hands and then those on her feet. And she started running in the middle of this forest towards sounds she heard until she heard the sounds of what sounded like motor cars on a road. And the rest is history. She was able to roll herself down the hill to the road and escape.
Just a short pause here to tell you about the Academy of Social Sciences, the organisation behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences, and as I hope you know by now, we are a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. As president and host of this podcast, I know just how vital the social sciences are in our society, from education to government, business and finance. Social scientists are at the forefront of tackling the most pressing issues of our time. And in this podcast, we bring you some of their best ideas to shape the way we live. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. this remarkable book you've written with Julia Gillard, former Prime Minister of Australia, this revisiting the notion that women face not just the glass ceiling, but glass walls and glass cliffs, and still do. Is there any sign of movement, or do you still feel that all the things that have concerned kind of you and your career would still confront someone trying to reproduce what you've done? If a woman was in the same position now as you were, would she face the same problems?
Yeah, well, I feel there's movement. And I feel there's movement because I see younger women they are so courageous, and some of them, they're just not willing to take no for an answer. And I really applaud that. It actually inspires me and makes me cheerful when I see young women leaders. However, even when I say there's movement, I think it's still too slow. I don't want to sit here and reel off numbers of percentages of women in different professions or in leadership positions. You can get them all from the book. But the bottom line is, if you look around, the pace at which change is happening of getting women in leadership positions is too slow. And that means they are still facing some of the same obstacles that we faced. So the world is changing for the better for women, but not fast enough. That is what I would say. And by the way, I have very mixed feelings about being called the first woman and the first African in the job, because I don't. Yes, whilst you might say this is great, but I feel it's been too long in coming.
Yes.
So it's not something to really be all that rejoicing about, in my view.
I understand that. What are the most effective strategies that could be implemented? I mean, in education or in the media or in the workplace, or actually kind of in family environments? How could, as an individual, you could contribute to change?
I think by being the change you seek. For me, it's as simple as that. If you want change, then you have to be prepared to take risks to effect that change. You can't sit by in one corner and say, oh, I want to change this. Okay, even let's say WTO, if you want a woman to lead, or an African, then you have to be willing to take the risk of being on the world stage. It was not easy. It was a very open, transparent competition between 8 people from 8 different countries worldwide. It's one of the toughest competitions I've been in, both technical and political. And it was a risk. And I know people said, I can't take that risk because if I don't make it, everyone will know I didn't make it. But if you want change, then you have to be prepared to take that risk, be out there, compete, do your best. So I want people to be the change they want. Don't always be looking for others to effect change, not even government to effect change. I think everyone in their own little way can help to change the world or change somebody else's life who is not as privileged. And if you change even one person's life and make it better for them, I think that's also big. That's also change.
Now, you've been instrumental in constructing and creating kind of networks in which, to support kind of aspirational women leaders. And I mean, they've been comparatively successful. I mean, what do you think is, what's the secret sauce behind that success?
Well, I think that, it's a lonely road when you're a leader. People don't know it. They think when you're at the top, it's everybody's at your beck and call. You're not. It's actually quite lonely. There are not many to relate to. So if you have a network of others that you can talk to and you can be where you can let your hair down and be honest with each other, it helps. That network also is also important if you professionally, if you're also networking with women who sometimes are in the same profession or in other professions where you have similar issues. Then you can share experiences. There's no one who has all the wisdom. You share experiences, you learn from others, and you also make connections. And that's the secret to success is what is in it for all the people there. So people in the network must feel that there's a win-win situation for them, that in talking to the others, whether it's informally, so just they have someone to exchange with, or formally, so they can learn something about how to navigate a particular situation they are facing in their profession. I think these networks help. The networks don't have to be exclusively with women, by the way.
Yeah.
They are men.
Yeah.
We can't also just be talking to each other. We have to include men. There are men who are very supportive of women, very willing to help. I've had them in my career. Actually, a lot of men have supported me all along the way because they understand that the world needs to make room for the rest of half of humanity. And so we should include men in our networks.
Almost every answer, you come back to this win-win. Mm. And that's a kind of way of looking at, it seems we're kind of very deeply rooted in your kind of way of kind of thinking, looking at the world, approaching leadership, approaching what you're doing, and the content of what you're doing at the WTO, for goodness sake. I mean, you talk about looking for win-win solutions, even at the moment when the clouds, trade clouds, are very dark. Where does that come from?
Well, I think it comes from experience. I've always found that looking, and perhaps it's because I'm an optimist by nature. And I often, when I'm confronted by challenges, my mind is working on, okay, what these are challenges, they're pretty bad, but what opportunities lie within them? And I also try to put myself in the shoes of whoever I'm dealing with. What do they want out of this situation? So you can come in with what you want, but if as a leader, you're not able to also put your mind into what the other person wants, then I think it may not result in very good outcomes. So I always try to think, okay, what is that person or the other side looking for? I may not agree with it, but perhaps we could work out some approach that would mean that the two sides end up with something reasonable that they can go home with. And that's the win-win approach. And I think in trade, you know, that it's trade negotiations can be very intense and very difficult. And you don't want people to leave the table feeling they gave everything in and lost out and didn't gain any. So we've got to look for win-win outcomes where nobody gets it all, but everyone gets a bit of what they're looking for, if not all. So that kind of governs my philosophy. I tend to approach people thinking, okay, what can I do? How can I approach this issue or this person? Thinking of what they want, what I want, and how the two sides can come away with something reasonable in the middle. Sometimes there will be no way to find a win-win if you're being offered a thing that is really bad. But most of the time, if you find that if you reach out, you can find some compromise that both sides can live with.
How dangerous do you think the situation at the moment is, to the extent that actually Donald Trump, you know, doesn't believe really in win-win. He wants winner-take-all. I suppose you could say, so far, he has not talked about leaving the World Trade Organization in the same way he's talked about leaving the World Health Organization or the Paris Accords. So I'm very interested to get your kind of, you know, your helicopter view of how you kind of perceive the American administration, whether they, when you talk this language, whether they kind of get it, or whether they are really out just to be unambiguously winner take all, and devil take the rest.
My comment will be on the WTO and why I think this organization has some very important attributes for its 166 members, and maybe why we see all members. Staying in and trying to find ways to deal with the complaints they have. I want you to know that the WTO is beyond tariffs. We're not just about tariffs. There are some other agreements we have that are very instrumental to trade. We are the home of an agreement called the Sanitary and Phytosanitary Measures Agreement, which basically provides a platform of trust for health and human hygiene in the products you trade.
Yep.
So all governments then build their standards and their regulations on this platform. But even if you don't have them, if a million tons of goods are coming into your country and you can't test every single one, you know that because the signatory, the goods are coming from a place that is a signatory to this agreement, there's a basic minimum of human health and safety in the goods. That builds trust. The same with products. We have the technical barriers to trade agreement that guarantees or sets the standards for products. You know, without them, there's no trust in trade. And any member that goes outside that is risking having goods and services delivered that, you know, may not be up to scratch. So we are beyond tariffs. I'll just mention one more, the trade-related intellectual properties agreement, which provides and safeguards innovation, you know, and allows those who innovate to benefit from it. American businesses earn about $136 billion a year in royalties from innovations they've made protected by this agreement. So we have other things that are going on at the WTO that people don't know about. And I think that is why our members find us valuable and would want to work, I hope, within us. Yes, we need reforms, and we are not afraid of reforms. We are undertaking some. We need to do more. But this may be the reason for members to stay in, because we have some very, very important, we have important pillars of world trade that are not easy to replicate or to match.
That's very impressive. And actually, I've left feeling more optimistic at the end of this half an hour than I was at the beginning. do you feel, I mean, service sector trade is the story now, and in particular digital trade, I mean, streaming services that move across frontiers. I mean, is that an area where you're ambitious for the World Trade Organization to start setting a framework and some common standards?
Well, I absolutely believe so. I think the future of trade is, I always say, I have this phrase, the future of trade is services, it is digital, and it is green, and it must be inclusive, meaning we need to reach out to those who have not benefited as much from trade, much as trade has lifted up 1.5 billion people from absolute poverty in the world and created prosperity. We also acknowledge that there are poor people and poor regions in rich countries, and there are poor countries who have not benefited as much. Therefore, we must also find instruments to include them in trade. But digital is very important in that. I'm very excited by the opportunities in services trade and in digital trade. Services trade is growing faster than goods trade. I know everybody focuses on goods because it's easier. You can feel and touch them. And, you know, in $30.5 trillion of world trade, we have about $25 trillion that is goods trade. The balance is services. And of that, $4.25 trillion is digital trade. But this is growing very, very fast at 9 to 10%. So I feel that the future is really digital and that we need to, at the WTO, lay the foundations or the rules to govern digital trade. And we do have negotiations going on an e-commerce agreement that would help to lay the basic foundations of that. So this is an exciting area. It may enable developing countries, poorer countries, to really leapfrog and be more productive and to trade more. We need to build infrastructure to enable them to do that, of course. But it's very exciting. And young people and women, in particular, trading digitally in developing countries. And that, to me, is quite exciting. I see that as the future.
We've really come to the end. Is there kind of one comment, one remark, one something you want our listeners to take away from this? Is there one thing you'd like to ram home as a kind of farewell remark?
Wow, that's pretty tough. I just want to end where I began. These are difficult times, but there are always opportunities in the cloud of challenges that we often see. Let's all take a collective deep breath, keep calm and chill, so we can take considered decisions to deal with the uncertainties. Thank you.
Dr. Ankojo Ewele, inspirational. And let's hope the world listens to you. There are win-wins even at dark moments. Thank you so much for giving up your time, and great good luck in the months ahead as you help to navigate the world through these difficult currents and cross currents. Thank you.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, who can be found at acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. Thank you so much for listening.